All right, our next case is 11-890, State of Ohio versus GMAC Mortgage. Mr. Lieberman.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Dave Lieberman for the Attorney General. With me at Council table is Jeff Laser from my office, as well as Ben Moran and Phil Cameron, who represent the private homeowners in this case. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, over the 30-year lifespan of a typical mortgage loan, from the first payment to the last, the homeowner is interacting with just one entity, a servicer like GMAC. So all the account management and the payment processing, any legal notices and property tax assessments, loan modification requests and customer disputes, all GMAC.
Is there any contract between the servicer and the homeowner?
There is no contract or payment agreement between the servicer and the homeowner, but that does not change the application of the statute. There's no privity requirement in the CSPA, and the General Assembly made that clear in 13-4501C. And my favorite case that illustrates this point is the Bordinter-Buick case, which we cited to in our briefs. In that case, you had the first dealership take a salvaged car, spruce it up, sell it down the line to a second dealership, to a third dealership, who then sold it to an end-line consumer. That consumer did not have any payment relationship with that first dealership. That consumer did not have any contract with that first dealership. But because that car went down the line with a misrepresentation, the consumer had a CSPA claim against that first dealership. So there's no privity requirement.
I have another question. Let's say you have ABC Bank and it handles the mortgage. It gives the mortgage. It's the mortgage holder. Doesn't ever sell it, doesn't have a service provider, third party like this group doing it. They do all of their services in-house, and they decide they need to foreclose in-house. Are they subject to the CSPA?
They are not subject to the CSPA under the immunity in 5725.
But they are doing all the same functions after they do the, what you call the pure real estate transaction. They are doing all the same functions as GMAC does, but they're doing them in-house.
That's true.
So one group would be subject to the consumer sales protection and the other would not be subject to consumer sales protection?
Well, Your Honor's question referenced two different immunities and exemptions that run through the CSPA. The first immunity is the 5725 immunity for banks. And so if a bank keeps it all in-house, the bank cannot be sued under the CSPA. But that bank, by virtue of being a bank, is subject
to... But all of your arguments apply to the bank. They're giving them a service. They're providing a benefit. You have a whole list of arguments as to why the Consumer Sales Practices Act applies to GMAC. Every one of those arguments applies to the bank after they're done with the actual real estate mortgage.
Because the 5725 immunity afforded to banks is afforded based just on the identity of the business, be it a bank or an insurance company. Now, the reason why that was done in the CSPA is because banks are heavily regulated under a whole nother set of laws, state laws and more so federal laws and federal regulators like the Federal Reserve and the Office of the Comptroller. So those banks would be subject to investigation under another set of laws, but it's based solely on the identity of the business or enterprise.
Aren't you asking us to judicially extend this when your argument really should go back to the legislature and have them clearly identify that this is covered?
No, we're not, Your Honor, because the 5725 immunity relates only to the bank. It can only be invoked by the bank. If you are a non-bank mortgage lender, for instance, you are covered under the CSPA. It is based solely on the identity. And the district court had already sorted this out in page one of its certification order. It made very clear that GMAC is not an entity as defined by 5725, so it is not entitled to invoke that immunity.
So, Mr. Lieberman, as a follow-up to Justice Stratton's question, I too have struggled with if GMAC is stepping into the shoes of the bank, why they would not have the same immunity. And so the only other two states to look at this are Kansas and Utah, and yet in their statutes they have very specific language that allows them to enforce consumer transactions because it's defined under what a supplier is. Ohio does not have that language, and so help us understand how GMAC doesn't just step into the shoes of the bank.
Well, as far as I'm aware, no court in the past 30 or 40 years since the CSPA has been enacted has allowed an entity to jump in the shoes of a bank or an insurance company under 5725 and then claim their exemption. Now, to Your Honor's question about the language of enforcement, there's an unbroken line of cases going back for 30 years which have subjected debt collectors to the CSPA. And those cases are not challenged here. And debt collectors are enforcing consumer transactions because they fit within the broad language of the statute. Is GMAC here in the business of affecting a consumer transaction? And the answer is yes, and we can answer that by going to the plain language of the statute. There are three elements: consumer transaction, supplier, and a deceptive act. Let's take the first element. Is there a consumer transaction here? Absolutely. GMAC calls the homeowners. Our customers are consumers. They are receiving a monthly check from them made out to GMAC, and they are doing everything with regards to the administration, management, and servicing of the loan accounts. All the legal safeguards and notices are handled by GMAC.
Counsel, if the homeowner doesn't pay, I'm trying to figure out what the financial arrangement is between GMAC and the bank. And if the homeowner doesn't pay on their mortgage, does GMAC lose income?
GMAC would lose that monthly check, but it would be GMAC who would send the notice to the homeowner.
Doesn't GMAC send the monthly check or the majority of the monthly check to the bank?
GMAC takes a cut of that check for its services.
That's my point.
And then sends it off to
the bank.
That's
my point. If they don't get the monthly check, GMAC doesn't get paid.
That's correct, Your
Honor. So the consumer is paying GMAC.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. They are transferring
directly.
Yes. They are the GMAC is affording services to the homeowner. They're getting paid in response.
And so you still say there's no privity between the homeowner and GMAC? If GMAC is being paid by the homeowner, and if the homeowner doesn't pay, GMAC doesn't earn or is not compensated.
I didn't mean to suggest that, Your Honor. That my response there was simply to say that there was no contract or no contract between GMAC and
no written contract.
Exactly. And I apologize if I misspoke, but I just wanted to make it clear that having a written contract, having an agreement.
Well, let me ask you this: if a homeowner says to their bank, "I borrowed money from you. I want to pay you directly. I don't want to use GMAC."
The homeowner has no choice. The homeowner is thrust into transacting with GMAC. The homeowner cannot fire GMAC as his servicer. And if we can step back from it, but those types of arranged marriages occur all throughout the marketplace. Favorite examples: a tow truck driver tows a consumer's car because it's double parked, or a debt collector goes after a consumer. The consumer is not choosing that tow truck driver. The consumer is not choosing that debt collector. But there's still a transaction between those two entities, and the CSPA kicks in. So we absolutely have the first element in this case. And when we have these arranged marriages, that's an even greater reason why we need statutory protections. In an ordinary consumer transaction, the consumer has a choice. The consumer can select A, B, or C. Who do I want to do business with? But not here.
But in essence, they choose what bank they want to go to, knowing that the agent of the bank is GMAC.
No, not at all, Your Honor. When a homeowner enters into a loan with a bank, the bank will instruct the homeowner, here's who you're paying, here's who you have to pay every month. And those servicers can actually switch during the duration of the 30 years.
But that's up to the bank on whether they switch or not.
Yes, Your Honor.
But initially, the homeowners instructed at the time of the mortgage closing, GMAC is going to be your servicer.
Yes, Your Honor. We have it at its core, a consumer transaction here. GMAC is supplying those transactions to consumers, therefore a supplier under the Act.
But is that for the benefit of the homeowner or the benefit of the bank?
The homeowner absolutely receives a benefit from this. Now, when GMAC or
wait
one of the other
while,
services...
Wait a while.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The bank doesn't have to formulate a department for collection and processing of payments.
That is
so they just sort of offshore this to somebody else.
The note holder is no doubt getting a benefit.
They collect all the benefits of it in terms of the dollars.
The banks or the note holders are, of course, getting a benefit from it, but so are the homeowners.
And it's simply incidental to the homeowner whether the check gets mailed to an address on High Street or an address on Front Street. It's the same check, but they're two different servicers, and the contract is between the bank and the servicer. That's right, isn't it?
The bank, yes, the bank is receiving a benefit, but the homeowner is...
The contract exists between the bank and the servicer, isn't that right?
That is correct, Your Honor. But the homeowner is absolutely receiving a benefit.
What difference does the homeowner care whether the check goes to High Street or Front Street?
It's not just the payments, Your Honor. It is the servicer's responsibility to provide all the legal notices and safeguards that are required by law. It is the servicer's responsibility to handle any loan modification requests. It is the servicer's responsibility to handle any...
But wait a second. If those are not initiated by the consumer... Where's the benefit? Just say the consumer's paying regularly. There's no need for loan modification. They don't really need to have any interaction except to write a check, put a stamp on the envelope, and mail it off. Where's the benefit to the consumer?
When the servicer is doing everything that it is supposed to be doing, the consumer is not going to notice very much. But what happens when a servicer...
Just wait a minute. Under that circumstance, tell me where the benefit is to the consumer.
Well, these are it is the servicer's responsibility to do a lot of the administration relating to this loan account.
For the bank.
Okay, so let's look at when the servicer is not performing these services. The homeowner's account may be out of order. The homeowner's payments may not be properly credited. The homeowner may lose eligibility.
That's not what we're talking about here.
But it's this intimate connection between the servicer, the services, and the homeowner. When the servicer does not offer these services and does not do it correctly, it is the homeowner who suffers. And that's the connection here.
And how does the homeowner benefit when the GMAC files a foreclosure? As a homeowner, I sure wouldn't consider that a benefit of a service.
That is not a benefit, and we don't suggest that it is. But we have
a service. But you say that is a service.
No, Your Honor. The service are these ongoing transactions that GMAC...
If that's not a service, then how do you reach liability to GMAC for the alleged false affidavits?
It's the servicing relationship that is the transaction.
Are you saying that by paying the real estate tax for the homeowner... Out of the monthly check, that's a service? Is that what you're talking
about?
That
is part of the service that GMAC is offering to the homeowners.
Well, isn't that the benefit of collecting extra money and earning interest on it for a period of time until the payment is made to the treasurer of the county?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Your Honor.
But when everyone makes a monthly mortgage payment of $963 a month, portions of that are either for real estate or some other amount other than the loan amount.
Yeah, and the consumer...
And who gets the interest on that money during that period of time?
I think it goes into the homeowner's escrow account that the servicer holds.
And that payment then is a service to, you think, the homeowner, not to the bank?
I think that the homeowner... All we need to prove is that that there is a transfer of services to the homeowner. Now, all of the things that I listed are things that the homeowner benefits from and the homeowner suffers from when things go wrong. And the best line of cases that we have to support our position here is the debt collection cases. Now, when somebody goes after a consumer for a debt to collect a debt, that is not for the consumer's benefit, but that is an act in connection with a transaction triggering the CSPA. And so we have all three elements in this case. We're still at the pleading stage, and we're entitled to go forward.
So, Mr. Lieberman, are you broadening the idea of consumer transaction to anything in which services affect the consumer? It seems that's what you're suggesting here.
Not at all, Your Honor. The GMAC and the other servicers are providing, they're not affecting the consumers, they are providing them to the consumers. They are doing the direct communication. They're handling the consumer's complaints. They're handling the consumer's loan modification requests. This is not something that incidentally impacts the consumer. The consumer has an ongoing involuntary marriage with GMAC. That certainly meets the plain definition of the statute. And if I could, can I reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal? Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Lips.
Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Jeff Lips, and I represent the respondents in this action. And as you know, we're here today to address three certified questions before this court. I think actually all three of them are probably resolved by the question as to whether or not there is a consumer transaction that has occurred with respect to the mortgage servicing relationship. The CSPA is very clear that it is intended to regulate sales conduct. In fact, the word is in the statute itself. It is designed to deal with some transaction where there was a transfer of either a good or service or something of that nature. There is no such transfer with respect to this case. And in fact, if you listen very carefully and you read the petitioner's brief, they focus on the back end. They almost jump completely over whether there is actually a sale or transfer. All the cases that they cite, there is at foundation some consumer-related transaction. Here, what we have is we have a mortgage loan that, as has been indicated, could be serviced in-house. And in fact, the only reason the mortgage servicers are there are by virtue of a commercial agreement that was entered into between the servicer and the owner of that particular loan. The duties run to the owner of that particular loan. Nothing runs, no obligations run to the individual consumer here. There's simply no transfer of any kind. Frankly, there's no benefit of any kind to the individual consumers here. Their responsibilities are fixed by that mortgage loan when they negotiate it and enter it into it. All the servicer is doing is enforcing those obligations and protecting the collateral.
Let's assume for the purpose of argument that the affidavits that were filed were robo-signed and false. Is there another mechanism by which there can be liability other than the Consumer Sales Practices Act? Are there other causes of action?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think it's pretty clear, and we referenced it in our brief, but that mortgage servicers are, in fact, regulated and affected by different causes of action out there, and that's why it's very important to focus on this particular claim, because they're trying to fit it into a box I don't think it fits. For example, RESPA, the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, has certain regulations with respect to notices that are applicable to the individual servicers and what notices and obligations they have to inform the borrowers. There's the Truth in Lending Act with respect to certain conduct related to late fees and delinquency charges. There's the Fair Debt Collection Act. And then, as we all know, our former Attorney General is now in charge of the Consumer Financial Protections Bureau, which is charged to prevent unfair, deceptive, and abusive practices involving mortgage
services.
There's
just a common law fraud available?
And there's also common law, is what I was going to say. There are common law claims, and in fact, they were asserted. Common law claims have been asserted in this particular case that's before Your Honor. So there isn't a need for
the Consumer Sales Practices Act. One of the reasons they want that is because you have the treble damages and the attorney fees award.
I can presume that, Your Honor, that's one of the reasons they want to do that.
But if you approved common law fraud, you'd be entitled to punitive and attorney fees, would you not?
If the jury awards punitive damages and attorney's fees, obviously the court can set the attorney's fees in a common law fraud case. But
counsel, activity that is complained of, the robo-signing without verification or actual truth in the verification, is that the type of activity that would come under the scrutiny of all of those regulatory agencies that you just mentioned?
Well, it certainly would come under the common law fraud claim. With respect to the regulatory agencies, I guess the one that's easiest for me to identify would be probably the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which does have some responsibility.
That's the brand new
Under the Dodd-Frank Act, yes.
Yes. Okay, but those other ones that you talked about, doesn't seem to me that they're there for the purposes of dealing with a problem that is before us. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I think under the Fair Debt Collection Act, for example, if a mortgage servicer acquires a loan that's in default and then engages in certain conduct related to that, that could, in fact, be implicated by it. But
do you have any examples of the type of cases?
I don't have any examples of actual cases that have been litigated in that context. But, okay. You know, let's go back to the fundamental point that I think we've raised there. To get to a foreclosure action, you obviously have to conclude that it is, under the certified question, that it's a consumer transaction in and of itself, which, of course, it is not. It's adversarial. It's the commencement of a right to try and obtain title to the property. Now, In terms of affidavits and activities, as we indicated in the brief, there is under Ohio common law this Witness Immunity Act. There's also supervision by judges. So I think that in terms of policing, whether or not there's robo-signing affidavits or false affidavits, that's the responsibility in the first instance of the jurist that's charged with the foreclosure action. It is in the context of a pending action. So you don't need to somehow find a cause of action to pile on top of.
Well, wouldn't it be first the responsibility of the lawyer who goes into court and files this?
Absolutely. It's the responsibility of the lawyer to make sure that there is, in fact,
the judge should be entitled to believe that the lawyer upholds his oath of office and makes certain that any affidavits are correct.
And from my client's perspective, we're prepared to defend each and every allegation, and I understand we're not here to argue over that, as to whether or not there were any false or fraudulent or improper affidavits that were filed. But remember, other than in the default situation, and some of these affidavits and claims rise in the context of summary judgment, you have an adversary on the other side, which will contest whether or not that affidavit's accurate, and you have the judge that will make the calls in the case. So again, this isn't a harm out there that's hanging in the air that needs a cause of action to be found. It's very real in Ohio. It's a judicial proceeding. It's in the context of a pending judicial action with a judge and, in many instances, an adversary on the other side challenging it. So I think that to the extent there's something that happens prior to a foreclosure action, you have these other causes of action out there that are available to you. But if you confine it just to the affidavits themselves, they arise in the context of litigation with a judge and a lawyer, as Your Honor indicates, having some responsibilities to make sure as an officer of court that a proper and truthful testimony is being submitted.
Mr. Lieberman had analogized to debt collection processes. Could you comment upon that?
Yes, I have a couple comments on that. It's debt collectors are not mortgage servicers. I think there's a line of cases, and it was certainly cited in the amicus of Barclays on those cases that distinguish from that. But if you look at the cases dealing with debt collectors, there's a couple points to keep in mind. One is at the foundation of the debt, there's always a consumer transaction. The foundation of this claim is a mortgage loan, which sets certain payment terms and responsibilities to pay. The other aspect of debt collectors that you need to keep in mind under the case law is that debt collectors often buy the debt. They become the owners of the debt. They buy charged-off debt or contested debt, so they essentially become the owners of it. And those debt collection cases say the consumer transaction is when the debt collector takes a liquidated debt and tries with the consumer to reduce that to a monetary payment in exchange for a release. That's the consumer transaction that gives rise to the debt collection. Now, the foundation of all of the debt collector case law that you can carry back to is the Celebrezze versus United Research case. I believe that came out of the appellate court up in Cuyahoga County, and it's never been adopted by this court. It was at a time where there were assignments that were being used to try and take advantage of a holder in due course right and strip the person that has incurred the debt of rights and obligations to or defenses that they have. That was the environment in which that case was created in, and that was a policy decision. It was not based on an analysis of the Consumer Sales Practices Act. It was to try and find a way to avoid debt collectors taking an assignment, saying they don't have any defenses to them, and then going after the consumer. It's a policy decision that has been followed by a number of courts, but never ruled on, to my knowledge, by this court and accepted as the basis for finding consumer sales practice liability. So I think there's a lot of difference between the debt collection line of cases. And remember, we don't own the debt in the sense that we're trying to liquidate it. We have a commercial agreement with the lender that then sets forth what our responsibilities are in terms of servicing that particular debt. So
do you have a responsibility to foreclose if the loan is there, or is that the bank's responsibility?
Ultimately, if you look at the agreements, and we did attach two of them in the appendix, ultimately every conduct, a step we take, is for the benefit of the owner. And if you get into loan modifications and that kind of activity, is again up to the lender to let us know whether to enter into that modification. And I would suggest that the same type of discussion would occur, for example, as to whether or not you go into a foreclosure. There may be instances where the lender doesn't want to have that money incurred under the agreement associated with the foreclosure action where it's underwater. There's simply not enough equity in it. So, again, the master that the servicer has is the person that it has entered into a commercial agreement with. It's not providing
any. The questions that Judge Zahari sent to us are, really, does the servicing of the residential mortgage constitute a consumer transaction? And the next one is, does the prosecution of a foreclosure action constitute a consumer transaction? What is the sale or transfer in the prosecution of a foreclosure action?
Absolutely nothing occurs that would even begin to be a consumer transaction. I think if you look at the petitioner's position, they don't even advance that. What they try and do is change the question, and they suggest, well, really the foreclosure is in connection with a consumer transaction, and we've talked about whether or not mortgage servicing is a consumer transaction, but even the in connection with on the foreclosure is not a proper analogy, because the in connection assumes something related to the consumer transaction flows into this conduct. There's a break when you get to a foreclosure.
And on the servicing of the loan, there is no transfer between the homeowner and the servicer. The transfer is between the lender and the servicing agent. Is that your view?
Yes.
Would you have the authority, would GMAC have the authority to do a loan modification or to do a deed in lieu of foreclosure? Can you make those decisions, or do you have to go back to the bank?
If you look at the agreement, there are certain parameters, as often happens. There's delegated authority within certain ranges where the servicer could take those steps. But again, it's a defined band of delegated responsibility. And then always it is for the benefit of the owner, with the owner having the ultimate say on it. So in terms of loan mods and deeds in lieu and that kind of conduct, it's, again, defined by the lender and decided by the owner of the loan decided what parameters will be given.
So unlike the debt collector, GMAC is not purchasing these loans from the bank. This isn't a secondary paper market. You're simply contracting with them to do, for simplistic purposes, an administrative service is what you're arguing.
Absolutely, which may include some follow-on where the borrowers get into default, where maybe there's loan mods or ultimately a foreclosure. But it is essentially a relationship that arises to an existing debt, not something we bought that we control. The last question I did want to address just briefly was the third question, which is whether or not GMAC is a supplier. And under the definition of the statute, in order to be a supplier, you have to affect or essentially initiate the consumer transaction. Well, we don't have a consumer transaction here, and I would submit it's important to note that the model consumer protection statute that formed the basis for the CSPA did have the word enforce in it. And when the General Assembly implemented the statute, they left out the enforcement. And that is very important, because all that we do as a mortgage and servicing entity is we enforce the existing agreement based on the terms that we've entered into commercially with the owner of that particular note. And so, again, in order to have...
Let me ask, is there any times when you, as the servicer, would advocate for the consumer with the bank? For example, if the bank, for whatever reason, doesn't correctly record the payments that pass through the GMAC, and a consumer contacts you as the servicer and say, you know, I, for whatever reason, have noticed the fact that the bank has not, I called the bank for a payoff and it's not, doesn't jive with what I think I owe. Can you investigate that for me? You investigate it and you find out there was a problem at the bank. You have the bank correct that. You get back to your consumer and say, we've taken care of it.
I don't know about that particular scenario, whether that happens. Obviously, the servicer does have some contact with the borrower and is administering the account. So there may be instances in which there is some effort to make sure that the account is being properly administered. But again, this is not our relationship as a mortgage servicer is dependent upon the terms of the commercial agreement. Now, there are government programs and government support that we do subscribe to as a company and participate in, where there is you know, some effort to try and counsel and help the borrowers. But again, it's not the per se mortgage servicing under the agreement itself, which defines what we're doing. What you're suggesting is something that may be outside of the four corners of the agreement itself.
Other than the case that you referenced from the 8th District Court of Appeals, have these questions arisen and been decided by any other jurisdictions, any other state Supreme Court, to your knowledge?
In terms of whether or not real estate is?
In terms of whether or not a
servicing?
A mortgage servicer is engaged in a consumer transaction.
Well, I think Justice McGee mentioned that there's at least Utah and Kansas cases out there, but they, of course, have a clear indication that real estate is within the four corners of it. The only other case that I would cite is there's the Minnesota cases that the amicus cited with respect to whether or not an incidental benefit is sufficient. I think it's the Rossback case specifically dealt with a mortgage servicer and whether or not facilitating the payment was a sufficient benefit. But that's about the closest that I can give to you as in terms of analogous cases out there.
Thank you.
I see my time's out, so if there's no further questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Lieberman, you have less than a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll just try to make
Mr. Lieberman, before you start, and I know you have less than a minute, but what is the practical impact? I mean, clearly the Attorney General has the ability to protect consumers, but these individual foreclosure actions are proceeding on a different track, and this CSPA Act is in federal court. I'm just trying to understand where the various cases are.
The individual foreclosure cases are proceeding before the state court. This CSPA action is in federal court. The Attorney General brought this suit to investigate and enforce the responsibilities of the CSPA against the mortgage servicing industry. And if GMAC's propositions are adopted by this court, that will neuter the Attorney General's ability to police this entire industry. Now, just two or three...
Unless the legislation changes.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's not...
But going back to your question about what role – is GMAC an advocate for the consumer? Do they have a relationship with consumer? The answer is yes. In other court proceedings and court affidavits and congressional testimony, GMAC over and over again talks about our consumers. Look at all the services. Look at all the solutions. Look at all the efforts that we are undertaking on our behalf. Look at the Fannie Mae servicing guide, which is incorporated into the servicing agreements between GMAC and the note holders. That guide, which we – quoted extensively in our reply, lists dozens and dozens and dozens of actions that servicers are required to perform for the consumers. And to my last point, Mr. Lips mentioned the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act. Our litigation is analogous to that law. Under that federal law, the person that owns the debt can go in-house, collect the debt, and he or she would not be subject to a federal action. But if the owner of the debt goes out and contracts with a debt collector to go pick up that debt with the consumer, that debt collector is covered. So just because the owner of the debt, in this case the note holders, may be immune from the law, does not change the fact that when they outsource it to a company, to an entity that doesn't have that immunity, that entity is covered.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.